Good afternoon. Welcome to the Thursday afternoon session, the seven laws of teaching. When you hear the word laws, some people have come up with some interesting laws. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. It is illegal to lay your hands on the Queen of England. At face value, that sounds like a good one. But what about Queen Sinandra, Queen of Thailand, when she finds her boat capsized and she's in the water with crowds on the shore, well able to rescue her, but standingly they're passive, waiting for somebody to do something? Because to lay hands on the Queen of Thailand would be a capital offense. She found herself in a dilemma. Or what about in Arizona? As far as I know today, it's illegal to shoot a saguaro cactus or to kill one. Saguaro cactuses can grow quite tall. I tried to proportion it there somewhat. There were two men who saw one of those and they had guns, and probably like any one of us wanted to see what would happen to that thing if you blast some holes through its trunk. So they aimed up and went blam, blam, shot into this thing, and one of the topmost limbs toppled off. Made applesauce out of the one fella. Killed him. So today, it's illegal to kill one of those saguaro cactuses. Are those the kind of laws that we're talking about today, where you can just inadvertently, oops, teacher died? Is that the kind of laws we're talking about? Well, they oftentimes don't have that immediate of effect. You don't walk into the classroom one day, break one of these seven laws, and you're fired the next day, at least unless you've done something too dramatic. But generally, it's one of those things that when you don't realize and you ignore it for a while, the effects of that can really compound and cause a lot of stress for you and chaos for the student. And that is what this book is about. It's the overarching laws that are going to govern any effective teaching. We're familiar with gravity. We're familiar with germination, the law of sowing and reaping. It's the same way. 17-year-old Randy Gardner stayed awake for 11 days straight, winning some for kind of competition. But the Guinness Book of World Records, they decided they're not going to do sleep contests anymore, because sleep contests, believe it or not, can cause medical conditions that are unwarranted. So they decided we're not going to do that because we don't want people killing themselves. If you're a mason, a cook, a pilot, you follow laws. Imagine if you just decided, let's throw two cups of table salt in here instead of two teaspoons. There's laws you have to follow in order for you to get good results. So as we go through this thing, just hear and try to absorb them. A lot of them are very common sense. This book was written by John Milton Gregory, and he had a passion for the art of teaching. He was committed to Christ as well. And in the first edition he wrote, he had Bible references. You could call the first edition the sanctified edition. The second one, they took the Bible references and references to God out. So if you have an opportunity, get that first edition there. It doesn't take long reading through that till you see his passion coming out. So hold on tight. Let's get into the laws of teaching. The first one is the law of the teacher. The teacher must know that which he would teach. I'll say that again. The teacher must know that which he would teach. Go ahead and repeat that with me. The teacher must know that which he would teach. Now you might be thinking, duh. A teacher not knowing what he's going to teach? I mean, wasn't that what he was hired to do, is to teach? But you see, unless we understand the lesson, we can't effectively teach it. He says there's four basic levels of knowledge. It's So what that little tower is there, the four basic levels of knowledge. The first one is faint recognition. If I say 1 Corinthians 12:9, my strength is made perfect in weakness, you might have had a recognition there with, I heard that earlier today, or I heard that yesterday. And you might have a faint recognition of where that's at. That's level one, to be able to hear it and faintly recognize it. Level two is the ability to generally recall and explain it to others. So I understand that when we are weak, then we are strong. So when we're discussing, maybe as friends or brothers or after church, we're talking about this verse a little bit, and we can understand that when I'm weak, that God is strong, and that makes sense. We can talk about that somewhat. Level three is well able to explain, prove, illustrate, and apply it. So now in our discussion, we're actually trying to find proofs for, is that really true that when I'm weak, God is strong? Or did someone just dream that up? How do we know? And to be able to articulate the context of that verse, Apostle Paul is not one who you want to compete with when it comes to intellectual capacity and stamina and learning. This is who is saying this verse. He's probably topped all of us. And yet, he found himself limited. There was a barrier in his life he couldn't get over. It was stopping him. It was a hindrance where he thought it was. And that moves us to level four. Deep appreciation in conduct changed by it. So, now that we understand when I'm weak, then God is strong. So when I'm teaching and I cannot get it through to that student, there's a roadblock there. I figure out how to teach this. Do we start to get fearful and frustrated and maybe going to the board and the teacher and we've got to figure this out? Or is our first response, thank you, God, I needed this. This is just right. Here's a chance for you, God, to work this, because obviously it's out of my control. You said when I'm weak, then you're strong. Here you go. Let's watch, see what God does. To where that verse is not just some intellectual knowledge out there, but when I'm faced with this in the classroom, it's who I am. And I have a deep appreciation for that understanding. So those are the four levels that he talks about. There's five dangers here that he talks about. Will you know more than your students? Let's hope. But there is a chance that the students may teach you as well. You'll be in class trying to teach something, and a student might actually help you out with it. That's happened before. Don't assume that you know more than your students, because that may not be true. The second one, the student is the one who needs to study and work hard to know the material, not me. I just grab the book, I scan, I know what that is, come to class. All right, students, get to work, bury your heads deep and figure this out. Lead the student in what you expect of him. If you never sweat as a teacher studying something, how would you expect your students to know what that looks like? Your student ought to see in you what you expect in the student. The third one I'm supposed to have a 10-minute class here. I think I have enough stuff to talk about to have them up for 10 minutes. Why in the world are we coming up to class in the first place? It's because we have something to teach. And if there's nothing to teach, then by all means, leave them in their desk. There's no righteousness in 10 minutes. The goal is to teach this thing. If it takes 5 minutes, then you stop at 5. If it takes 15 minutes, then you'll use 15 minutes to get the job done. To get the point across, don't use time as a factor in that. Obviously, don't go too long. You might have to break that up. Another one is using an obscure lesson to teach my hobby horse. We're not really sure what this lesson's about, but that one sentence there talks about airplanes. And we have a grand airplane story to tell the students, and they're all loving this. But when they go back to their seat, they're like, what does that have to do with this lesson? Number five, using big words and fancy expressions to hide the fact that I don't know much. Imagine if I got up here and said, I said, glittering generalities. They are blazing ubiquities. For one, I didn't know what I said, and you didn't either, probably not. Sometimes we're tempted to use the lesson terminology because we don't actually know what we're talking about. Beware of that. Great knowledge leads to passion and enthusiasm. Is there a subject that you is flat for you? I don't want to say it's 100% of the time, but generally speaking, that's which we know little about. Generally, we're not enthused about it. One of the first keys is to really dig that thing up. An astronomer can get very into his subject. When he tells you to look up at Orion at night and look at his left shoulder, that star Betelgeuse, it's so big if that we grabbed our sun and hurled it into it, it would just completely disappear. And if you zoomed in with our most powerful telescope, you might find a little speck on that thing. That was our sun if it still existed. Study fresh. Keep fresh knowledge coming through. Relate the lesson to the students' lives. And learning a couple things is much better than throwing a broad array of things out. And I really struggle with that in this class because I'm throwing a lot of things out. But for them to leave with one thing is better than to not really have gotten 20 things. The teacher must know that which he would teach. Let's say that together. The teacher must know that which he would teach. The next one is the learner must attend with interest to the material to be learned. We're focusing off the teacher a little bit onto the people. If you'll notice here, we have two scenarios happening here. Fred and the billy goat. In two situations. One is attraction, the other one is compulsion. I'm exaggerating the compelled a little bit for the sake of the illustration, but you have two basic ways of getting attention with your students. One is compelling them, and the other one is attracting them. And hopefully you don't have your stick out to bring compulsion, but there is a sense, so when they come up to the class table, there may be a place to compel them, someone who's just distracted or not getting it, to just kindly get their attention, say, hey, look here. But you don't want your entire class to have to be compelled their attention. You don't want to have to constantly be telling them to look at you. Because if they're not attentive to what you're saying, they're not going to learn. They may be able to say some facts at the end that you said enough, but learning's not happen if they're not on the attracted side of the deal. So bring carrots along, so to speak. Bring something up that fascinates them as you're teaching, because that attraction is so important for that student to be learning. If they don't have that attraction, might as well forget that you're teaching. Nouns name a? All right, give me a noun that bounces. Anybody? A noun that jumps. A noun that wiggles. A noun that giggles.
Girls.
You're looking to produce interest as you're teaching. The notion that the mind is merely a bucket to stow my ideas in. Picture a first grader or an eighth grader with a bucket head instead of a mind. And your job is to pour all these things and drop them in there. And if they stay in there long enough, you were successful. That's not the picture we're talking about today. We'll get on to the other thing later. Four things to avoid. Wait to start your class till they're all looking at you. Actually, wait till they're all looking at you. forcing them to listen, the second one, after their powers of attention are exhausted. Approximately 1 minute per year, so a 7-year-old, 7 minutes, 10-year-old, 10 minutes, and so on. Try to budget your class time so that you're not going past their attention spans. My son Grant, if I hauled him out to my little sandbox and said, "All right, you've got to play," he would probably look for the nearest escape route out of that thing. If I drag our hose over there and turn it on a little bit, just to where there's a little trickle coming out, and just leave it there, make sure Grant saw me, take it over there and just walk away, 3 hours later I'll come back and he's still digging a little pond for this little trickle of water in there. The law of attraction there, attracting that student, if you get the right things, it's amazing how well that goes. Take advantage of new ways of explaining things. If you explain the same thing the same way year after year after year, day after day after day, it might get old. If you eat eggs every morning and noon and evening, they're just going to get old no matter how fresh they were initially. One way to get attention. To just stop. Use a variety, but sometimes too much variety can actually produce chaos. If you would do everything Jonah did yesterday in one class time, your students probably would not be learning much in their lesson. So you want to produce a little bit of that interest there, enough to keep them, but not so hyper-stimulated that they can't hold still in their seats anymore. Make sure you keep their interest in the subject. Make your lesson relevant, appeal. Do songs, stories, hide distractions. Provide thought-provoking questions. And maintain your enthusiasm. If you get to the point that you're just talking in a monotone for the whole class time, then chances are that their interest will not be very high after a while. Vary your voice because you're excited, and because you're excited, they'll catch on. So the learner must attend with interest to the material to be learned. Let's go ahead and recite that. The learner must attend with interest to the material to be learned. I'll turn the time over to Derek now. He'll have number 3 and 4.
So this is the book that he was talking about earlier, as far as this is the one that has all the Bible references and references to God taken out. I almost feel guilty having it, but it is still good. It's just there's a blessing you'll miss if you have if you get one of those versions. So first of all, in order to have a class, in order to have school, we must have a teacher. And the teacher must what? One word. Okay, what's the law?
No.
The teacher must know, that's right. Okay, so we have to have a teacher. What's the second thing we need?
Students.
We need to have a student, that's right. And the student must, in one word,
attend,
or in a simple word, maybe listen. The third law has to do with the language. And maybe in that case, attend is not as common of a word, so if you're teaching your class, you should change it to listen. So it's a word that the student can understand. Or in your case, I'm sure you understood it anyway, but use as simple words as possible. A teacher must know, the student must listen, and the language must be simple and common to both of them. The law, as on your paper, would say, the language used in teaching must be common to teacher and learner. And these laws seem very simple. They seem very basic. And they are. But that does not at all diminish their importance. You know, we all speak English, and hopefully your students all speak English. So we think, well, what's the issue here? Well, there are some words that have a double meaning. There was a girl who learned a new song at home about throws aside the dreadful paw, and she said, "Oh, I know him. He's in my class at school." And there was one little boy that was very anxious to see the wicked flea whom no man pursueth. Be careful with words. They can mean different things. Make sure your students understand. And here's a tip for discipline issues. When a student is acting up, we often just say, "Hey, cut it out," or "Stop that." And we just assume they know what we're talking about. Be very specific about the behavior that is wrong. Make sure you tell them that what part was unacceptable. Maybe he was poking somebody. Say, "You're not allowed to poke," or "We don't poke people in the classroom. We don't distract other people." Be very specific about the behavior that was wrong. Again, the teacher and student must be familiar with the language used. When I started teaching school in Texas, I had 8 students, and all of them came from homes that primarily spoke Spanish. Either the dad or the mom would have been from Paraguay and knew only Spanish or very little English, and so they would often speak Spanish at home. And one true student, she would have known Spanish and Guarani, and English would have been actually her third language. So it took a while for me to get used to that, of speaking to them, because there was a lot of English words that they didn't know. I'd be reading story, and sometimes there's things they wouldn't get because of that. Oftentimes, the quest for knowledge would simply become the pursuit of an untamed fowl, a wild goose chase. At one time, I think I seriously offended one of my students because I said something about him, and it was nice, I think, but he didn't understand what I was saying. Maybe it was just the way I said it, I'm not sure, and he was offended at it. It took me a while to figure out what was wrong, but I had said something that he didn't understand. Use words that are common to them. You know, probably not a good idea to tell your students to be malleable. They won't know what it's talking about, obviously. Teach the lesson in their own words. And this is where it might take some listening. Listen to them talk. Let them describe or explain the story problem or the lesson. Listen to the words that they are using and try to, as much as possible, to use those words. Don't just assume that they understand. Children are very good at nodding and smiling and maybe looking interested, but just because they look interested doesn't necessarily mean that they understand what's going on. You might ask them, you know, "Do you understand this?" And, well, they're going to nod their heads because they don't want to seem like they're dumb in front of their classmates, so make sure they understand. Check for understanding. Maybe even ask them to repeat the principle or concept in their own words. So maybe you can repeat, "What is Law 3 in your own words?" Any brave volunteers?
Make sure your students can understand what you're saying.
Okay, very good. Make sure your students understand what you're saying. The language must be simple and common to both the teacher and student. Good. Teach them new words, though. Don't just stick with the words that they know. Do teach them new words. Your students will love the word borborygmus. Maybe you had some trouble with borborygmus this morning before you had lunch. It's a very common malady that affects most of us anyway. Except it's kind of distracting in class when you're dealing with that. So teach them new words. Just do it slowly. Make haste slowly with teaching them new words. Make sure they understand the words that you teach, or the new words that you have before you introduce more new words to them. Take it slowly, but do it. Expand their vocabulary and illustrate new words in a way that they'll understand and make them curious about the meaning of a word so they look it up themselves. That was the idea there. But again, when you're explaining something to your students, make sure you use easy words that they understand. Please endeavor to curb your desire to exhibit your perspicacity. Use simple words in teaching. Okay, Law 4. We have the teacher must know, a student must listen, the language must be common to both, and Law 4, the truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. That's the law of the lesson. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. Always begin your class with review. Review the previous lesson that they learned, or maybe the previous concept that leads up to this one. If you're teaching about direct objects, make sure you go back to review about what a noun is. A noun does what? Right, names the person, place, thing, or idea. Or you can just say a noun names, and then ask what an action verb. What does an action verb do?
Shows action.
Okay, shows action or being. Excellent. So we have a noun, we have a verb, word that shows action or being, and then we have the direct object, which receives the action. And then you can explain about direct objects and tell them that a direct object is a noun. It always is a noun. It's never the object of a preposition. They'll get that confused all the time. Make sure you start with what they know, the familiar, and then you can progress into new territory. And sometimes you might have to backtrack. It's always disheartening when you begin a lesson with a little bit of review and then you realize that, oh, they didn't learn that very well. But it's much more important to go back and teach that well than it is. You may just have to say, okay, we're going to do some review this time, and next tomorrow we'll look at this new concept. There's no sense in going on to the new. You're wasting your time going on to the new if they have not understood the foundation of that concept. You have to take it step by step. If you're teaching them to divide fractions, you know, review multiplying fractions, because you have to. And then once they understand that, if they understand how to multiply fractions, and you simply tell them all you need to do is multiply by the reciprocal. Just flip that second fraction upside down, and then you're multiplying. It's very easy as long as they fully grasp the previous concept. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. How would you describe a zebra to someone who had never ever seen a zebra before? Say it looks like a
horse.
That's right. Just say it looks like a horse. You can't. It might not work to just describe it. You know, it's saying, well, it has four legs, it has a tail, it has. You could do that, but much more profitable just to simply say it looks like a black and white horse with black and white stripes on it, because they're familiar with that. They know that, and so they can use that to understand what a zebra looks like. In fact, think about the story in Acts where the Holy Spirit came upon the disciples. How did Luke describe those things, those objects that took place in that room? What did he say they heard?
The rushing wind.
Okay. But was it actually a wind that blew into the room? I don't know. Maybe it was. But it says that it was a sound from heaven. There came a sound from heaven as of a mighty rushing wind. He didn't know what words to use to describe it, so he used words that were familiar to him. And then what was on top of their heads? Okay, flames of fire. But was it actually flames of fire? I don't know. It says, there appeared unto them cloven tongues like as of fire. So maybe it was, I don't know. But it was something that looked like fire. He was just using the words that he knew. Especially like John in Revelation. He saw things that he didn't understand. He saw things he had never seen before. It talks about, these monsters with six heads and different horns, and he was just trying to explain it in the words that he knew. You know, sometimes we think if we repeat something three times or four times, and each time we get a little bit louder, somehow that'll somehow drive it into the student's head. But that doesn't work like that. It's better to repeat it with different words. Use different words to see if that will help understand. But again, we need to teach through truth already known. Have you ever walked up onto it? If you walked up onto two people that were talking, maybe they were in the middle of a conversation and you just caught the last end of the conversation, and you're like, what were they talking about? Maybe it didn't make sense to you. Well, probably it didn't, because you missed the beginning. You need the whole thing in order to be able to understand it. It's the same way with teaching school. They need the whole picture. You can't just start on different ground. You know, and even though you have to start on familiar ground, it's very important not to stay there. we always use that as, it's always pointing us toward a new concept, something that they don't know already. You're always working toward that. You know, how do you get to the second floor of a building? Okay, like climb the wall or what?
Through the first floor.
What's that?
Through the first floor.
Okay, but you're on the first floor. How do you get to the second floor?
Stairway.
That's right, a stairway. There should be a stairway somewhere, and step by step, maybe some of you can do two steps at a time, but step by step you get to the second floor. It doesn't just, you can't just jump from one floor to the other. It takes, just, it's one step at a time, and that's how learning needs to progress. We take it one step at a time. And as teachers, our legs are a lot longer than our students. And sometimes we can make those big jumps. But let's make sure our students, we're taking little steps so that the students can get each step. Find out what they know and use illustrations that are familiar to them. Maybe your students are farmers. Use illustrations with cows and horses and things that they are familiar with. If your students are mechanics, or if they like certain things, use things that they like and understand to explain these concepts. Math, you know, fractions and those things can all be explained through illustrations that they are familiar with. All right, I'll turn the time back over to Jaden for 5-6.
All right, picture with me a castle. And this castle is your student's head. It's inside your student's head. And you're the teacher, and you are bringing, in this case, you're the king, another king. You're bringing something up to the gate that you know is going to be helpful to the king inside. You want him to find out about it. You think it's the greatest thing on this side of sliced bread. But there's a castle wall right there. There's various ways to get through that castle wall. One of the best ways is through an open door. In ancient history, a lot of people have tried to scale it, bring battering rams, knock the door down. But typically, if you approach that castle with hostile intents, or apparently hostile intents, things are going to seal up tight. How would that be what a student is? So, law 5 is excite and direct the self activities of the learner and tell him nothing he can learn for himself. How does that apply here? So your student's mind is a lot like that, where you do not know what's inside the castle. You can see evidences of life in there by the voice. Back to your student now. You can see his actions. You can hear what he says. And that's evidences of what's in here. But you cannot do brain surgery and look in there and say, oh, he got this fact. Shut it back up. Let's move to the next lesson. Just can't do that. You are going to have to guess a little bit at what that is. And as a teacher, you build that relationship. You start to see what, perceive that. Excite and direct. What you got to do with this king in the castle is you got to do something out here. Get his attention. And he comes up to the wall and he sees this big colorful parade of exciting stuff out there. He's like, hey, let's let them in. And so he goes down and he opens this door and stands there and just welcomes all this stuff. If he looks over the edge and sees a lot of strange stuff out there, he's going to wait till he knows what it's about. Think of that as you as a teacher. You may look pretty intimidating as a teacher coming up to his castle door. And you better have a string of goodies here that looks kind of attractive to him. To where he looks at that and says, hey, I want that. Could I have it? Sure, bring it on. And so there's that interaction between you and the student, as you're bringing that stuff to him. and providing it. That student is not going to learn. Sorry, I'll say it this way. We can learn without teaching, right? You can go home and figure something out. You don't have a teacher anymore. So can your students. They can learn without your teaching. In fact, most of the knowledge they have is not. Most retained knowledge is self-taught. You might could ask, well, why am I even in school? If most of the knowledge they get is self-taught, what am I doing as a teacher? What you're doing is you're exciting them, motivating them, and then you direct them on a path filled with those goodies. And you show them this, and you show them this, and you attract them, and they want it. They're reaching for it and making it their own. I was working on the job the other day, and there was this little orange peg just right there in the dirt. And we could not figure out what that orange peg was for. A surveyor had come and pounded this little orange peg in, and the stake beside it said building corner. But according to our measurements, we were measuring this way and that way, and it apparently is not the building corner. We're not quite sure what that peg represents, and so it's confusing. Why would he do it there? And there's all kinds of other stuff to think about, but when I think about that peg, I go, what? The reason for confusion is because it's not linked. Just like if I gave you one link of a chain, you might put it up on the shelf as a piece of, for your motto or whatever. Is that what they're for? No, a link of a chain is only important when it's linked to everything else. So when you're providing knowledge, you need to excite their minds and direct it. Give it meaning. Show what it's linked to. A direct object all by itself is very boring, but when it receives the action of the verb, you're linking it. Wish I had time to talk to you about this thing. Anybody know what this is? Just throw it out, make a guess.
Raccoon.
Raccoon, good guess.
Dog.
Raccoon dog. It's a raccoon dog. That would be a fascinating thing, ask your students. So here's a cat. I'm sorry, here's a dog. How do dogs look? Okay. Now how do raccoons look? Now picture blending the two and you have a raccoon dog. And sure enough. Okay, so excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing he can learn for himself. Don't give him anything that he can get himself. The fifth one there, the learner must reproduce in his mind the truth to be acquired. See if you can finish this correctly. Who teaches best, teaches most or least? The teacher that teaches best teaches least or most? What would you guess?
Least.
Least? Good job. The teacher that teaches best teaches least. I don't remember what I was taught. I only remember what I learned. What's the difference? Learning is different than discovery. Discovery is like going out to your creek and finding this big lump of gold out there. That's discovery. Learning is taking that gold and processing it and making it useful and saving it for later. That's what learning is. And if I just give Ryan here the tape measure, say all successful contractors have tape measures. You're going to need that in life. If you're going to be a successful contractor, you got to have that. They all have it. There's no exception. You really need that. And so I feel really good because I just enabled him to become a successful contractor because now he has a tape measure. It's tempting as a teacher to hand out stuff to your students like that. Tell them it's really important. Here it is. and feel like we're successful. But remember the rule. He may not even know what it's for. He may not even know how to use it. And that's why it's so critical. I need to see him reproduce his knowledge as a teacher. So I would want, when I give it to him, I would want him to measure that and double check. Does he know how to use it? If not, I'll teach him. And we'll have him measuring stuff, and then I'll give him a square, and we'll work on the square. So when he gets out to the job site, guess what? He needs something measured. Hey, I got a tape measure. And now he measures it. Otherwise, he'd pull his ruler out and end over end because he doesn't know what his tape measure's for. Make sure that your student reproduces. Here's how. You teach them a verb is a word that names action or being. They give it back to you word for word. Do they still know what it is? Hardly. They don't know what a verb is yet, even though they can recite the definition. The second one is you add clear understanding to the thoughts. You tell them, okay, here's what a verb is. The third one, they can start doing the lesson accurately now. Verbs are action or being, and start deciphering between the verbs. And then four, learners begin to seek evidences for the listen. Wait, is the teacher right? And he begins to compare and dissect, and he's like, oh, the teacher is right based on my research. And then the student goes out and he writes a nice article, and he gets all the best verbs that he could possibly use for that article as level five. So you want to take them from not only giving them the definition, but you want them to be a writer at the end of the day who can reproduce what a verb is. That's what we want them to go to. And handing them pieces of information is not necessarily going to get them to that spot. We'll turn the time over to Derek to wrap this up. I'll take that.
Running out of time here. Law 7 says the completion test and confirmation of teaching must be made by reviews. The completion test and confirmation of teaching must be made by reviews. You know, Jonah, I think he said that something has to be repeated 8 times, or we have to hear something 8 times before we can remember it. But it's more than just repetition. We can speak something into a computer, and the computer may be able to repeat it exactly back to us, or even a parrot. A parrot can repeat things that we say back to us, but does it understand what it's talking about? So we have to be able to teach them. Like, for example, we teach our students A squared plus B squared equals C squared, and maybe they can easily rattle that off, but can they actually take it and out to the job site and use it to square up a building or square up a mini barn floor? Can they use it in different ways? Knowledge is useless without application. Knowledge is simply words and information. It's absolutely useless if there's no using it somewhere in real life. So can they use it in different ways to solve different problems out of the classroom? One thing about reviews is you can use them anytime. If we're waiting for hot lunch and lunch is a little bit late, but you have your students standing up, do some review. Review science facts. Review math facts. Review states and capitals. Review the names of the president. Names of the presidents. There's many, many things you can review. And if you always have a grab bag of reviews stored away in your head, then you can always do review with your students. You should always begin each lesson with review. I think I said that already. And maybe even end the lesson with a little bit. So review previous concepts, and then at the end of the lesson, you review what you've taught, which hopefully we'll do here in just a little bit. Review the 7 laws of teaching. It's amazing how review can help something stick. If you're teaching Bible memory or memorizing scripture, we would always say our Bible memory every morning. We would go over the Bible memory for that week. And it's amazing, by making your students do that every morning, maybe even a couple times a day, there's almost no study needed for Friday morning when Bible memory is due. They've just repeated it so often that it sticks with them. The review is very important. It's better to learn a little bit, I think Jaden said this, and learn it well, review it. Oftentimes we feel pressured to get through the textbook, and we're just going to skip these quarterly reviews or skip the reviews so that we can get through the textbook. But what good is the information going to do them if they don't remember any of it? So let's not, don't neglect to review the information with your students. Okay, reviewing the laws. You can turn your paper over to the other side. And you can help me out on this now. So a teacher must be the one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. The teacher, and it might be helpful to you just to simply try to put it down into two words. The teacher must know. Just remember that in your mind. Teacher must know. Law two, a learner is the one who attends with interest to the lesson given. The student listens. All right, law three, y'all read that one for me and fill it in.
The one who is used as the medium between teacher and learner must be common to both.
Very good, must be common to both. Neither purposely in different words than the actual laws, because the more ways you can memorize it, the more we know it's stuck in your mind. So we have a common language. We have a teacher who knows. We have a student who's listening. We have a common language. And then law four. Go ahead. The lesson
to be learned must be explicable in terms of truth already known by the learner.
Right. So the lesson must build. You cannot build on nothing. Build on something that's already there. Law five. Teaching is... That might be a harder one. Any guesses? There's a couple words that could fit, probably. Okay. No. Remember, we're trying to stir this thing up. We're trying to.
Attract.
Okay. Maybe. The word he has here is arousing. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to form in it a desired concept or thought. Or you could say, teaching is exciting the student's mind. We want to make them, we want them to be doing the thinking. Is that right, Jaden? Okay, law six. Learning is how do you reproduce something in your mind? What's happening when something is being reproduced in your mind? Thinking. That's right. So learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth. It's not just hearing it. It's not just saying it. It's actually thinking it in your own mind. And law seven. The test and proof of teaching done must be a reviewing, rethinking, re-knowing, and reapplying of the material that has been taught. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for listening.